I'm Pima County Attorney Laura Conover, and welcome to the People's Office Podcast. Our goal here is to share and discuss some of the most important information and issues affecting Pima County today. We're having real conversations and reflections on what you care about as we do our part to create change in the justice system. Welcome back to another episode of the People's Office Podcast. This is number 3. And I am very excited today to have two very special guests. Mr. Larry Starks is the Juneteenth Festival Board Chair.
President.
And delighted to have our new Executive Director of the Dunbar Center, Ms. Frieda Marshall. And it's an opportunity that we have when we do these podcasts to get a little bit deeper into a topic, so that we're freed up from sound bites and we can actually dive in a little bit more and learn about a topic at length. So thank you so much, both of you, for being here.
Thanks for having us. Appreciate it.
So of course it's February, so I'm going to start with just a question for the same for each of you. Director Marshall, if you would tell us what Black History Month means to you.
Oh, my goodness. It means so much. And I will say sometimes it's a little exhausting because it is a time where people try to cram all of the activities that make Black Americans or African American history relevant. But it is so much more. It's about resiliency. It's celebrating the accomplishments of all of those who came before us, remembering the challenges, remembering the disparities, all of that, but really celebrating those champions that paved the way for us to get here. And it's all about, you know, showing the African American community, Black Americans, how to be resilient and how, you know, it shows our strength that we have been resilient and we have to continue to be resilient in the face of injustices and racism and all of that. So it's a celebration, but also just remembering, you know, how strong we are together in numbers. So,
yeah, excellent. Yeah. That's true. For me, I'm going to say, honestly, it's really sad that we still have to have Black History Month. I'm going to say that, even though it began as Black History Week and it turned into what it is now, you know, Carter G. Woodson, one of my fraternity brothers. But the fact that, like Frieda said, that we try to cram everything into this month, it's really exhausting. And honestly, yeah. I try not to do that much during February. When people ask me about doing things for Juneteenth and others, I say, well, call me in March. Call me in April. Call me in May. Call me in December.
I'll be
more than happy to come out and talk to you about Black history or whatever else it might be. Because again, you know, it's easy to lose everything for 11 months and now focus right now. But for us, you know, with what she has at the Dunbar and what I'm doing, you know, not just with Juneteenth, but with other things, it has to be a month-to-month dialogue of history.
Right.
You know, because as you know, people are trying to erase American history. And I say American history because I said Black history is American history. So we have to be real intentional about those things.
Yeah, absolutely. I like that word. Yeah. In my head, it's like, that Black History Month is being intentional about celebrating, being intentional about remembering, but right. A lot of our communities are intentional about, you know, what that means to be Black, what that means to be African American in Tucson intentionally every day.
Right. And that's exactly what I was hoping we could get into today is the Black experience here in Tucson and in Pima County. Some of it from a historical perspective and then coming up to today, because I definitely want to hear about what's going on at the Dunbar and with the Juneteenth Festival coming up this summer. So historically, going back, there have been some very significant moments of prominent African Americans visiting Tucson, including a recent review we had of MLK himself visiting a couple of times. Larry, tell us what you will about the history of Juneteenth and some of the historical perspective that you can give us locally.
Being a native Tucsonan, you know, I grew up with Juneteenth. Some people don't realize how long we've been celebrating Juneteenth here in Tucson.
Right.
LLC began in 1970. How it actually began, of course, Juneteenth started in Texas, Galveston, Texas. So people, as they migrated here to Arizona and Tucson, other places, following the cotton and everything else like that, they were celebrating Juneteenth in Texas. They were used to that. So when they were here, they found other people from Texas say, hey, you know, we still need to celebrate Juneteenth, even though we're not in Texas. So it started as really small gatherings of families. It really started up on a mountain. There was a Doty family and some others who started just really small. They had a potluck with families. And then their friends are like, hey, what are you guys doing? Oh, we're celebrating Juneteenth. Oh, what is Juneteenth? So they explained to them what it is. Okay, well, I'd like to join you. And then it just became a large gathering in the park where families could gather at Vista del Pueblo Park over on A Mountain. Started real small. Then it got really, really big. I mean, where I would say, like, when I was maybe a sophomore in high school, I'll tell you what year that was. I got 81, a long time ago. So, I mean, if you didn't make it to the park by sundown, you wasn't going to find a parking space, because that's how much it was. So it evolved, and then I think it moved to Kennedy Park after that because it got bigger. And so it just really became a force in the community, you know, where everyone every year looked forward to Juneteenth because of the bands. You know, people look forward to coming out and playing at the festival, the bands and the poets, mm-hmm. and everything else like that. So it became really a mainstay. But over the years, I think it just became so big and kind of stagnant. You know, and COVID hit, and it just became kind of, where do we go from here? Because you really can't have a virtual festival. Yeah. It just don't work. Mm-hmm. So when I came back, I became president in 2021. And our first year coming back at Kennedy Park, we went back, mm-hmm. to Kennedy Park. It was a nice outing, nice festival.
Yeah.
Last year, Keno Sports Complex is becoming bigger. And for me as president, one of my mantras is, it's a movement, not a moment. So what that means for me is, how do we make Juneteenth, the festival, more in Tucson and Southern Arizona? How do we partner with other agencies so that we're not just a one-off? We're not just in June where people look at. So we donate toys in December. We work with Boys to Men. We work with the Dunbar. We work with Emerge. A lot of different things so that people understand we're just not about June 19th. That is the umbrella. But under that, we're looking at Black life in Southern Arizona. So that's how kind of it moved from where it was to where it is now. That's 53 years of celebrating. That's what we've been doing, and we're just trying to keep it moving and keep it, you know, vibrant so that people understand it's not just a Black holiday. You know, two years ago I had someone email me and said, Mr. Starks, we're a family. We adopted a young Black girl and we'd like to bring her to Juneteenth. Is that okay? The fact that they had to ask was like, okay, we still need to work. We got work to do. Just understanding that, how we need to move forward with that whole thing. So
Wow.
So Frida, we're welcoming you to Tucson.
Yes.
Yeah.
Which is very, very exciting to have you as the new executive director for the Dunbar.
Yeah.
Where are you coming from, and what experiences are you bringing here to us in Tucson?
Oh, absolutely. I was originally born and raised in Cleveland, Ohio, and lived a few places. But I, before coming out west, I lived in Atlanta, Georgia for quite some time. And just listening to kind of like the history of in Tucson, and just a lot of people don't know that, you know, when the Dunbar was established in 1918, it was established as the segregated school for African-American children. And just talking about prominent people that came through Tucson too, a lot of anyone of note visited the Dunbar, and two in particular that always stick out when we give our tours is Marian Anderson came to talk with the students, and Langston Hughes. And Langston Hughes played a huge part when he was talking with the students, and they didn't have an auditorium. They didn't have a cafeteria, so they would line up in the hallway of the historic building, and it would be so hot that some of the children would pass out because of the heat. And it was Langston Hughes that advocated to the Tucson School Board that we have to get cooling for these students, and that's how they got their swamp coolers.
Wow.
And so the Dunbar was, you know, a place to visit, and people would come and talk with the students about reaching the stars and you know, being, you know, motivated in the face of disadvantages, not having the same books, having books that were no longer relevant passed down. And so that when you talk about the people that passed through, you know, even then it was exciting to hear that those people thought enough of the small group of African-American children here in Tucson. But I come to Tucson with an experience, especially in Atlanta, where there's a larger population, right, and a lot of collaboration, a lot of celebration of the culture. And so it's important for me to be at the Dunbar, because I went to the first historically Black college, which was Wilberforce University. Mm-hmm. I joined the very first Black females, Black sorority, Alpha Kappa Alpha Sorority Incorporated. And then I'm overseeing the Dunbar, the legacy, the Dunbar. Yeah. And to me, I like first, but you have to think about, why do we have first? It's because, right, African Americans were, things were created because we weren't included, we weren't allowed to participate, mm-hmm, or join. And so all of these establishments, you know, were created, yeah, because we needed a place to celebrate, connect, HBCUs, collaborate, definitely, you know, and see ourselves. And so I'm so proud to be at the Dunbar, because that's what we do. We're preserving that history of the Dunbar, why it was created. We don't ever want to forget why, right, it's created, but we want to be unapologetically African-American, celebrating, mm-hmm, all of the great things, all of the great people that graduated, you know, that came, mm-hmm, principals and, yeah, lawyers, oh, and, yeah, athletes, yeah, came out of, you know, a time where it was designed for us not to succeed, but, you know, they excelled anyway. And so that's, you know, yeah, that's my take on the history, you know, in Tucson, and why it's so important for me to be leading as an African-American female, yeah, at the Dunbar Pavilion.
It was right about this time 2 years ago when Sam Brown joined us as our civil chief, that as he joined us, looking through photos of the Dunbar was the first time he learned that his grandfather had attended the Dunbar. Mm-hmm. And he was very, very proud of that.
Yeah.
So Frida, tell us a little bit about your vision coming in as the new executive director of the Dunbar, and where you see this going.
Lots of plans, lots of vision. When the Dunbar Coalition acquired the campus, a lot of people don't know the city tried to give away the campus, and mm-hmm, they couldn't get any takers. And so the coalition was formed, and they charged the coalition $25 for that. And so it just kind of reiterates, you know, yeah, just, wow, kind of, yeah, like the challenges that we face. And so the original vision was that communities that service, that provided resources for the African-American community were housed there. Mm-hmm. And that was the place where people felt safe to come and celebrate and remember and honor the legacy. And that's the vision that I have now in a more modern, you know, in a modern vision. Right. You know, we want African-American businesses who, for whatever reason, are left out of commercial deals, can't obtain, you know, the traditional brick and mortar because of funding, or even the lack of education on how to write business plans and that sort of thing. We want to be that hub for those small businesses, entrepreneurs who are operating out of their closets, mm-hmm, who are ready to grow and evolve their businesses, that they get the education, they get the support, and that they're able to use the Dunbar as a launching pad for minority businesses. We want that we will have a business empowerment center where all of that's going to take place. Wow. We want to have those resources available, especially health and wellness, specifically related to African American health care challenges. You know, we always face hypertension, diabetes. And so we want to be able to be that place where you can come and get information, get support, specifically related to, you know, what we face as African Americans. We think of blood drives, but we never really think about the blood, the amount of blood that's needed for people, yeah, facing sickle cell anemia.
Right.
And
right,
so those are kind, right, of the things that, you know, not keeping anyone out, but we also want to be really specific to the needs of the African American community and preserving the Dunbar as that safe and welcoming place for African Americans to collaborate, mm-hmm, to be unapologetically, right, Black and feel welcome, whatever dialect right. that is, you can, right. you know, all of those things that make us who we are as a community, we want to have that space to celebrate that and partner with all the other, our allies who believe in the fight against injustice with us and lock arms with us, but really having that, holding that space mm-hmm. yeah. for us to say, you're welcome here. If you don't feel welcome anywhere else, you're welcome here at the Dunbar Pavilion.
Absolutely. Well, and Frida, you've just used a key word that's on my mind constantly, of course, in my job here, which is injustice. Mm-hmm. And I'd like to hear from you both about what you're hearing and seeing in 2024 as we continue to come out of COVID and we're continually assessing our local criminal justice system. What is top of mind, Larry, if you want to go first?
Whew, okay.
I know, right, I know.
No, I guess I could take my Juneteenth hat off and put right. on my everyday job hat.
I see.
I'm a retired correctional professional. I retired from juvenile corrections as an administrator over parole. After that, I came into kind of the education community, like, okay, I'm done putting kids in prison. How do I now stop them from going? What do I need to do? Education. So let me go into the education system. So currently I work for the CAPE school, which is the Corner Porter School for Pima County. So co-located at the juvenile detention and the jail as a transition specialist. So I helped them get back enrolled in school and jobs, and I proctor GED tests for them and different things like that. Every day, it's really, I see injustices every day. I went to the jail today. I told you I left today. One of my students there, he's 22, got his GED finally after 4 years. I mean, big, big thing for him. But as I look around, I see that there's, I think they told me, 156 kids, and I call them kids, under the age of 22 okay. at the Pima County Jail. Right. In the juvenile pod, just the hotel juvenile pod, I think there's 31. At the juvenile detention center, there's about 30 kids in there. It's just really despairing. And when I talk to them, and I'm like, okay, what's going on? How can I help you? What was going on with you? And a lot of them just don't see any hope. It's really sad. You know, okay, well, did you try this or did you try that? Or, you know, how are your parents? You know, what is your connectivity to the community? Who do you connect to that's not doing other things? And a lot of them, I say a lot, but a lot of them don't have that connectivity. So we're trying to figure out ways in our community. We're doing call to action for men. How do we connect our kids to the community so that they have someone they can lean on or talk to or whatever it might be? And I ask a lot of them, would you have made the same decision if you took a beat? If you took a half a second or a second to think, before I pull that trigger, before I robbed this store, before I did A, B, C, and D, would you have done what you've done? Right. 80% of them said no.
Right.
80% said no. And again, just seeing that, and then, you know, going back to, a lot of them feel as though the system is against them. And I see it. If I have a 16-year-old person and they say, okay, well, you're facing this charge. If you go to court, chances are you'll get 40 years, but if you don't, we'll give you 10. 16, I can get out at 26, maybe 24, I'll take it. Well, did you do it, sir? I didn't. Go to court. I don't want to take a chance on getting 40 years because
right.
it's built against me,
right.
especially black and brown kids.
Right.
That's
yeah.
what they see, right. is that the system is built against them. I also teach criminal law at JTED with high school students. So
wow.
teaching them, just hearing their mindset of yeah. what they believe about the justice system. We have to do a better job of teaching our kids what it really means, what it's about, the jury duty.
Mm-hmm.
We have to teach that, because if they don't understand what that means, they're not gonna do it. And I say, okay, who do you want judging you? Because that's what it is, the jury is judging you.
Right, that's right.
Do you really want a jury of your peers? Or do you want someone who doesn't look like you or know you?
Right.
I want somebody who looks like me and knows me and understands right. what I've been through, not somebody else. Right. That's a jury of my peers. Right. So for them, when they turn 18, I'm like, you have to register to vote. You have to, because if not, you never know if you, your family member, or someone else like that come up. Right. they're going to be judged by somebody who doesn't have any idea of what they're going through.
Right. Yeah.
So that for me is the injustice of how do we get these kids to realize in a moment that their life is going to be totally different. Yeah. Just for that half a second.
It's going to take a completely different turn. And Larry, we've asked a lot of the juvenile system in the last 3 years because we are not transferring children downtown to be tried as adults anymore, wherever the law allows mm-hmm. us. You mm-hmm. know, they're 15, 16, 17. Arizona state law says they have to go if they've committed some of the top offenses.
Right.
But everyone else we're keeping at juvenile. And then, of course, the challenge is going to be how do we use that time? Since they're at juvenile, access to the CAPE school instead of trapped downtown with in the adult jail with next to nothing.
Right.
So it's we've put a lot of pressure, I think, on the juvenile system.
Yeah, and it needs to be more pressure, honestly. Because here's when, like I said, I've been in the system so long, there was this push for DMC, disproportionate minority contact. So we know that black and brown represent high proportion of kids involved in the system. Mm-hmm. When I was there, it was maybe, I think maybe over 100 kids at any given time in juvenile detention, a lot of kids. So, but what happened is they reduced the amount of students, of kids. However, DMC is still there.
Oh yeah,
so
oh yeah, yep.
I understand you reduce the number, but the disproportionate minority contact is still there. So how do we
persists.
Rid of that?
Yeah.
I'm not worried about reducing the numbers. I want to reduce that.
Yes.
If we're 4% of the population,
right.
how can we be 25 or 30% of the prison population? Mm-hmm. It makes no sense.
Yeah.
To me.
Right.
I mean, I know how it happens.
Right. Right.
I know how it happens.
Right.
It just doesn't make any sense.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Right. So, yeah.
And as Frida and I were talking about earlier, I was mentioning that I had spent, I went to Alabama last April with a group of district attorneys nationwide. Mm-hmm. And we spent 3 days in Montgomery and then a fourth in Selma learning about how our criminal justice system is traced from the very beginning.
Absolutely.
In slavery and then convict leasing.
Absolutely.
And Jim Crow right into what we have today and how hard you have to fight against that to not be part of perpetuating it.
Yeah. And I rarely get to say this out loud or you know, just really, it's, you know, you people talk about a broken system. The system is not broken. It was systemically set up that way.
Right.
And so how do we maneuver? How do we just cancel out? It's that old way of thinking. And I'm going to jump around here because one of the things I would love to see taught, which is a skill, adults need to learn it, but children need to learn it too, is emotional intelligence. How do you regulate your emotions? And it's that 6 seconds that, you know, that turns a feeling or emotion into it. You have 6 seconds to decide what you're going to do. So behavior is a choice.
Right.
And I think we need to focus a lot on the educating children, but educating adults as well. And then our law enforcement, it starts there. It's the racial profiling that still happens, you know. And I think you were kind of asking, you know, well, kind of like, what is the temperature in the community?
Right.
We're scared. We are terrified, and we may not always say it. We're afraid to drive out of our driveways and wonder, you know, am I going to make it home?
Yeah.
And you talk about, you know, my son a few years ago in Atlanta. He's a college student and was on break and was traveling from his girlfriend's house. And it was after 11 o'clock p.m. and he was stopped and racially profiled. And they had the dogs out and all that. And this was in a suburb of Atlanta. And so as a parent, you're constantly afraid. As you know, a person of color, you're constantly afraid. And if it had not been for someone who was not a person of color who pulled over and asked what was going on, I don't know if I would have saw my son again that night. And so it's doing a better job educating our law enforcement, doing a better job, and I'm being really political, doing a better job of hiring But it's just how we're dealing with mental health issues, how we're, you know, how we're identifying those. And they're not mental health practitioners, but there's, you know, mental health first aid. What does that look like when someone's in crisis versus criminalizing them? So there's just so much. But what do you do with a system that's not broken? Right. It was designed that way. And how do it's having more people, you know, not just being an ally on in February, but, you know, speaking out, being those who are in places to change policies, to change, you know, rules and regulations when we can't do that. Those are the allies. When you're doing something, when no one else is looking, when you're doing things that's really, that really matters, changing the rules, changing the policy, speaking against it when you see it, you know, and not after the fact. So it's exhausting sometimes being African-American. It is. But, you know, Larry, I didn't know you worked in the correctional center. I worked with men, you know, transitioning out in Atlanta, and the system was set up as soon as they released. There were police officers waiting to rearrest them because they weren't able to pay their back child support. So it's how do we connect the systems and change the systems that are designed to reincarcerate and profit off of incarceration.
That's interesting because and even that's good, but in the community, even, you know, a lot of people, you're anti-cops. I'm definitely not anti-police, definitely not. What I am is anti-hatred. I am anti-racist, whoever you are, wherever you come from. I don't care what walk of life you're in. So we have to be, again, intentional in the hiring. We have to be intentional about the training. When I was post-certified in Glendale, I went through that, and I'm watching, I'm seeing everything that pops up. When I'm shooting targets, I don't see people who look like those guys popping up on my targets. They look like me and brown people popping up on those targets. And I mentioned it. I said, and they thought I was joking. I said, where's the white people at? I need to shoot a white person. He's like, well, no, 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 it's not that. I said, well, but if you look at the targets, all of them, I'm turning and seeing are black and brown people. And you even told me there was a black guy in the corner that could have shot me because I didn't shoot him.
Oh, my goodness.
So training, scenarios. Chief Kazmar is really good about, because I spoke with him, said he's very welcoming and very open to say, hey, you know what, Larry, what can we do to make this better? Because it has to be. And again, it's not, people don't have to feel bad about it. It's just what it is. How can we get better at training you to do your job? Right? It's any business you're in, if you're an accountant, whatever else it might be, if you're an accountant and you're losing money, somebody gonna say, hey, here's a better system for you not to lose money. If you're a police force and you're doing certain things, here's a better way of policing, right? So how can we make this better for Southern Arizona? Because I think a lot of times here, if you look at it, Tucson is really spread out.
It is.
It wasn't that way when I grew up.
Right?
Yep. I grew up in Western Hills, south side of Tucson. It was black and brown mainly.
Right.
North side, Sugar Hill, black. South Park, black. A Mountain, black. But now everybody's kind of spread out. You really don't come into contact with that many black people. However, how are they being arrested so much?
Right. When I'm out on nights and weekends, I have seen very intentional, to borrow a word, intentional recruitment going on, especially by the Tucson Police Department. Mm-hmm. And we worked really hard in our arrival in January of 21 to show that, to build on what was here, because the culture that was here lifted up the idea of women prosecuting violent crimes. That was quite unheard of. And that was normalized here, but it was a very, very white agency. And so that was a huge push when we first came in. But when we talk about, I want to get back to Frieda mentioning policies. The two things that we looked at immediately that we thought called to us to do was that the data and studies we looked at said, convinced me that I don't think we're ever going to get race out of the death penalty. And so the only sure way to do it is to not seek it. And the second thing we did was to stop disqualifying people from treatment now based on prior convictions.
Right.
Because if neighborhoods were over-policed, over-surveilled, over-arrested, over-charged, over-incarcerated, then if you count priors against people for what they need now, you're just on that cycle.
Right.
But I say this because that was the first year, and we want to move into that second layer of, mm-hmm. okay, what next? And mm-hmm. how, and that's why I want to always be present and listening about what's on the horizon. What can mm-hmm. we be doing as the next yeah. step?
Yeah, and this is where Larry and I, we have a lot of synergy, because you think about the mass incarceration and what it was designed to do. I mean, it wasn't
right.
a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
What it was designed to do was to take the black male out of the home. And once you remove that headship, once you remove that relationship, then you're left with single parenting homes. And so the woman does not know how to play both parts. And so when you have that, and then it doesn't make it easy for the children to go and visit, because mm-hmm. they're sent somewhere that financially the woman can't go
mm-hmm.
and visit. And so now you have a relationship that is estranged, and it's just estranged in the black family. So that is systemic, but it's the programs that need funding specifically for black and brown youth, that where there is the absentee father, where there is an estranged relationship, it's that call mm-hmm. to men, because they need that role model. They need to be taught emotional intelligence, regulating, so that they are making better decisions. But they need to see men that look like them, mm-hmm. right, mm-hmm. who are successful, who are, you know, who have survived out of, you know, unsurmountable challenges mm-hmm. or seemingly. And that, you know, that's kind of like where we have to be that bridge, and also be willing to bridge the gap. How do men who have been incarcerated for 10 to 12 years, who have not had a relationship with their children, with their families, how do they reconnect? It has to be a stronger focus on reunification while they're in prison.
Right, right.
Reunification.
Start before.
What does that look
right.
like? Because we know when people are released, there's a short window that yeah. determines their success of whether reoffending
right.
or entering to society successfully. And so we really have to focus on better programming in prison, you know, that focus
right.
on
yes.
family, it focus on helping them obtain skills that they're not going to learn something in prison or incarcerated that they won't be qualified to practice when they're released. Don't let them get licenses that as a felon, they will not be able to practice.
Yes.
Because it adds to the frustration.
Yes.
And what are they
going to yes.
turn to? Things that are comfortable.
Yes.
And so there's just so many things. But
yeah.
what Larry and I can do
yeah.
is have that safe and welcoming place, making
right.
sure that the Dunbar continues to thrive and it exists
right.
with the right support, and having those programs that reach out to those youth that have, whether the father is incarcerated or not. Making sure that there's that presence, that strong role model presence, giving them choices, mm-hmm. giving them examples. And I just don't see where there's a lot of funding or a lot of support, because that does, you know, it takes time and it takes commitment, and it takes a safe place to meet, you
right.
know, where they can
right.
be themselves. So yeah, it's a big challenge that I think we just continue to face.
Wow. That I'm sorry, that's a good, one of the things we're doing with Juneteenth and Goodwill and Voice to Men is
yes.
we do this call to action for men of color, is what we call them, right? So we talk about black men showing up, but we got to have black men take care of themselves also.
Right.
Because how do we take
right.
care of ourselves, right? And then go out and help, because if broken men break other men.
Mm-hmm.
So we got to figure out in our own communities, in our own ways, because we all have trauma. We all have different PTSD and everything else like that, and whatever else is going on with us. So how do we as black men work with each other? Not just black, but black and brown men, say, we sit in a circle and say, you know what? I'm feeling kind of messed up right now. because this is going on, that's going on. Yeah. I don't feel as though I can go help this young person because I'm not okay. Yeah. Most Black men and brown men aren't going to go to counseling. One, they probably can't afford it. Two, it's the stigma of if you go to counseling and, you know, it's a stigma against it. But if I could sit here as a brother and say, hey, you know what, man, look, let's talk about that. Yeah. You're going through a divorce. I know that's hard.
Yeah.
Your child just got arrested. I know that's difficult. Your daughter is in the streets. How does that make you feel? What can I do to help you? Those are the conversations that we're going to start having in the community with us, for us, by us. Because we can sit here and have these other kind of minutia conversations all day long, but it's not going to help. You know, I can't go help kids if I'm hurting.
Right.
I really can't.
Right.
Because all I'm going to do 9 times out of 10 is hurt that kid. Mm-hmm. So we're going to help kids, but what we're looking to do is, okay, how do we fix ourselves? Now we're going to help our kids. You know, you talk about like, you know, child support, things like that. The young men I talk to who have young kids, they are afraid of the courts. They're afraid.
Right.
You know, I mean, you having a baby, well, are you going to go file child support? No. Why not? I said, well, child support is going to help you see your child. They don't think about that. No, the government is going to track me and take my money. Then I'm going to go to jail if I can't pay it. I'm like, but what about the visitation one? So I'm like, okay, well, yeah, that helps them with that. Yeah. We got to teach them those things. We got to have parenting classes for kids, not just the men, but for the mothers and the families of these kids who could come together so that women aren't out there, you know, by themselves with these young kids. I talked to a young lady today. She was out of jail. She's 19. She's visiting her boyfriend who's there. They just had a baby a year ago. She's struggling.
Yeah.
So
yeah, there it is.
We have to have those real conversations for our community. You know, again, Black men having those real true life conversations that we couldn't have before.
Right.
Yeah.
You know what I'm saying? I couldn't have, I didn't have this conversation with my dad about, you know what, Dad, I'm going through a divorce. He's been married for 50 years. I don't know how you felt about it or not, but I didn't ask and he didn't say.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right.
So, but somebody, I should have been able to talk to somebody and say, hey, you know what? Here's what I'm going through. And it's not feeling good.
And now you're normalizing that for the next generation.
Yeah. Exactly.
That it is okay.
So for my sons now are seeing.
Exactly.
Oh, well, you're in a relationship where you're more likely to end up in a divorce anyway, son. Don't get married. Yeah. But those are my conversations with my boys. You know, like, don't do it.
Well, and these
wait until whatever. But that's not cool for them to hear that just because that's my opinion.
Right.
I need to talk them through it.
Right.
Instead of telling them what to do.
Right.
And
right.
Even going back to the men that are incarcerated that either are estranged from their children or may get some level of visitation, the relationship is strained. But we know statistically that if you have a parent who is incarcerated, the likelihood or the percentage of your child or that child being in justice involved increases substantially, right? And so it's how do we fix that so that we're equipping that parent to be able to talk about past mistakes or decisions, and sometimes they're in there and it's not, they're wrongly accused and they've taken a plea deal because they were told, well, you'll get out faster than if you fight it. So it's those things that how do we connect that so that we don't have children who offend because they don't have, you know, a way out or they're trying to make ends meet because mom is working 3 jobs,
right?
Because the price of living keeps going up, rent goes up and all of that. And so they're trying to help mom out and they're doing, you know, something that they shouldn't do. So there's so much of the family component that has been destroyed because of mass incarceration. And it dates back to slavery. That we want to say, oh, just get over it. No, it is embedded. That is trauma. That is an experience that has become part of the DNA of the African American community that is very difficult to erase. And it seems like when we make headway, there's always a law. There's always something. There's always something major that happens that it may not look identical. It may not be identical, but it certainly resembles, you know, what has already been set in place to keep families, to keep those families apart and to keep the incarceration going. So
that is true.
Yeah.
One, feeling a little like one step forward and two steps back, and having to find ways to fight against that. I know here, one of the difficulties for the workforce here is that once a file is opened, a harm has already occurred. And so we feel like late to the game all the time. But, you know, you've both talked about, I think, you know, healing and restoration and being able to talk through these issues. And while we have the attention, let's say, of the kids in juvenile, it's going to be amazing to see these services go in there. You know, that Absolutely. If there's a population in there that is there longer than traditionally because they're not being tried as adults, then I'm really excited and optimistic to see all of what you're talking about get infused more and more in there, because I think you can disrupt. They're not facing adult consequences yet.
Yes.
And there's an opportunity to disrupt and interrupt.
Yeah, definitely. And even the kid, like I said, sitting at juvie, a lot of them are there, when they're there for long term, they're there waiting for a place to go.
Right.
You know,
right.
Whether it's through DCS or whatever else it might be, they're waiting for somewhere to go.
Yeah.
And I even tell my teachers, you know, a lot of times, is you got to be cognizant that these kids are dealing with trauma right now. The fact that they're away from their family.
Right, right.
For however many days it might be, that's trauma.
Right.
And so school might not be the first thing on their minds.
Right.
Right.
I have court next week. I don't know if I'm going to go home.
Right.
I haven't talked to my mom in 3 days. I hear my dad's coming back. My girlfriend's pregnant. Whatever it might be.
Right.
Imagine yourself in that place and you can't get to the ones who you need to get it from.
Yeah.
That's difficult.
Yeah.
And especially for a 12-year-old.
Yes.
13-year-old.
Yes.
Imagine that. In their brain, and I'm saying, hey, can you do your homework today?
Right, right.
Mm-hmm. And they get mad. And
right.
I'm like, we can't take it personal, because it's not personal.
Right. Yeah.
It's really not.
That's right.
It's about the trauma right now
right.
that they're exposed to. But like you said, how can we now, if we have a captive audience,
right.
how can we make it better for you? What can we do? I said, my job is transition. Eventually, you're going to leave.
Yeah.
Let's focus on what that looks like. Let's mm-hmm. visualize what that is.
Getting rehabilitation back into the concept of corrections.
Yeah.
You know, I think when we were all very young, it was there. You could mm-hmm. you could get education, you could get skills in a trade that actually got you
right.
a job.
Exactly.
Right. When you got back out. And right. I am looking forward to that in the next 4 years, is hoping, you know, at the state level, I think that's a big priority, is trying to get that back in.
Yeah, because that's half the battle with a lot right. of people who are reentering society is how
right.
do I feed my family? How do
right.
I feed myself?
Right.
How do I provide myself with shelter?
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you can do that, the temptation does not come to go back.
Absolutely. Yeah. Right. Hierarchy of needs.
Right.
It's the
exactly.
first thing.
Exactly.
Survival.
Exactly.
Survival. You know? Shelter.
Like, well, Frida and Larry, this has been incredible. It's been so educational and I think both historical and present day and shed a lot of light on top of mind issues. And I really appreciate you both making the time and sharing it all with all of us. So with that, we should conclude the third podcast from the People's Office. We look forward to the next one. Remember, you can submit suggestions for topics at any time, and we'll see you next month.
Thank you.
Don't forget to subscribe to our podcast and PCAO newsletter. We'll have links in the description. If you have a show idea or questions, just email us at thepeoplesofficepodcast@pcao.pima.gov. Until next time, thank you for joining us. To be continued.